For over half a century, London W12 7RJ Wood Lane became the spiritual home of British television. Designed by the architect Graham Dawbarn, this was the UK's first purpose-built TV hub with the cutting-edge camera technology, 8 bespoke studios, production galleries, and the now legendary BBC bar. Well, for many, BBC Television Centre came to represent the magic and glamour of British entertainment, light entertainment, glossy, glamorous shows, and hosted everything from Auntie's New Bloomers to Z Cars behind those famous double doors. To mark 10 years since the closure of Britain's most famous television studios, Beyond the Title welcomes some of the BBC's best-loved faces to remember and celebrate the history and legacy of TV's first dream factory. So, join Josh and the team as they remember BBC Television Centre.
Legendary writer, journalist and broadcaster Joan Bakewell achieved a family dream to be the first to go to university when she studied economics at Cambridge. Originally joining the BBC as a junior radio technician, she then presented small informative sections for the Light programme. In 1965, she joined the BBC Cultural Affairs programme Late Night Lineup alongside Dennis Toohey, John Stone and Michael Dean, which ran for 8 years on BBC Two and became the only programme to be broadcast for 364 days per year live from Television Centre. Throughout the 1970s, Bakewell fronted many hard-hitting factual series for both the BBC and ITV, before securing the thought-provoking Heart of the Matter in 1989. In 2001, Bakewell wrote and presented a four-part series for BBC Two called Taboo, a personal exploration of the concepts of taste, decency and censorship. Forever a reliable voice of reason on subjects ranging from Brexit, mental health and the ageing process, she tweets daily and remains one of the most defining voices in Britain. As part of Beyond the Title's TV Centre season, I caught up with an evergreen broadcaster to celebrate her memories of TV's first dream factory. Ladies and gentlemen, Dame Joan Bakewell.
So, welcome to this very special podcast, and thanks for contributing to our TV Centre season. The late Barry Cryer once remarked that if it's very seldom for people to become sentimental about buildings, but TV Centre wasn't just a building, what made it so special for your generation?
It was an very impressive building itself, architecturally. But when I was working in radio over in Broadcasting House, this was in the late 50s, the word got round that a new building was being built in Shepherd's Bush that would be entirely for television. And we were working in radio and we said, well, that weren't very important because radio is king. Radio is what matters. Television will never be that important. And we were very sneery about it. And a bit later, as the news of the size of the building reached us, we began to think, perhaps there'd be interesting jobs going in Television Centre. Perhaps it would be an interesting place to work. And slowly, one or two of us began to make approaches to Television Centre, the brand new building, and eventually I did go to work there. It was a very extraordinary building. It was purpose-built. It took into consideration all the demands of television at that time. A whole series of very, very large studios to take, Morecambe and Wise shows, musical shows, orchestras, dramas, full-scale dramas were done in full from studios. Its facilities were fantastic. And it also had all the social facilities. It had bars, it had dressing rooms, it had makeup rooms, it had places where people built the props and built the sets. It had dining suites and places where you could go for lunch with anyone who happens to be in the building. It was an entire ecosystem of television activity. Wonderful.
So beginning your career as a radio technician, presumably based at Broadcasting House, what was the feeling amongst other areas of the corporation about a purpose-built television centre? And to what extent did radio or the wireless feel left behind in what many saw as a new era?
Well, as I was saying, we in radio thought we would never be left behind. We thought we were the most important because, of course, it was still quite soon after the war, and broadcasting, radio broadcasting from the BBC had been very important during the war, broadcasting across Europe, across the world. So we had a huge political importance, and we thought television would be about frivolity and not really to be taken very seriously. So we poo-pooed it rather and sneered at it until we realised it was a place to go and get work. And it would be an exciting new technology, of course. That was what really did it, because we were all working in very limited studios. I was a studio manager turning the knobs, as you see in old movies. And it was the technical possibilities of Television Centre which was really attractive, because they put in everything of the latest facility, latest technical development. So that was exciting.
Architect Graham Dorban designed the look of it in the late 1940s in the accidental style of a question mark. But how did the slightly eccentric design add to the enigmatic, magical world which it created? And to what extent did its subtle imperfections add to its legend?
What was interesting was that the fact that it was this circle with a bit going out to the one side, which is where I had my office, by the way. It would of course the need would outstrip the facilities, but at the time, what was wonderful about it was because it was circular, you could have access to all the studios. Were built around the circle, huge spaces, and behind the studios, on the outer rim, there was the facility to go upstairs and look down through a glass-plated window into the studio and see what was happening. So at any one time, you could climb up and walk along an access and look at all the different shows that were being recorded. And that was very attractive because you thought, well, I wonder what's happening here, what's happening there, who's in the building, who might we get in touch with to come on my programme, which is called Late Night Lineup. So that was very attractive. It was the general sense you had that we were all working to make good programmes, whatever kind they were. Now, there was an exception to this, which was Current Affairs, which was still over in Lime Grove in rather grotty buildings. And they stayed there because the facility they needed was basically a studio, a desk and some lights. They didn't want to move around in their behaviour, in the programme pattern. So they stayed in Lime Grove, which, of course, has since been demolished. So the things that were going on in Television Centre were huge dramas. I mean, sets were done so that in one vast studio, you could do a live drama lasting something like 90 minutes with the actors moving from one part of the studio to the other, round the sets. And the writers had to be very careful to write in enough lines to allow an actor to leave the room in one corner of the studio and rush round to the other side and enter another room. He had to write lines saying, I'll be with you in a minute, I'll just go out and get the bus. And then there was a pause to let him get by.
In 1965, you secured a presenting role on the seminal BBC Two cultural affairs show Late Night Lineup.
Yes.
Embracing the liberation of the swinging 60s revolution, how do you think the BBC adapted their conservative attitudes in order to allow the show the ability to tackle the hard-hitting issues facing what was modern Britain?
Well, the interesting thing about Late Night Lineup was its brief was to talk about television itself. It was actually conceived within a department of the BBC. There were all sorts of different departments, you know, drama, comedy, entertainment, dance and so on, arts. And we were within something called presentation. Now, what you know of presentation now are all the trailers that we get. And that comes under presentation. But presentation, when BBC Two began, was very basic. They didn't know how to promote BBC Two. So they decided to have a programme that would talk about the day's programmes to come. And it was originally meant for 7 o'clock in the evening, and we would come on and say, hello, this is a new BBC Two, and tonight you're going to see this and that and the other. It was so popular that they moved it to late in the evening, where there was a larger audience, and we started to review programmes. We said on Television Tonight there was such a documentary, and we thought we'd invite people to come and talk about it. Here's the producer. Here's one of the people who were there. Here's some of the public. If it's a documentary about the police, here's a policeman to talk about it and to criticise it. So late at night, it became the place where people tuned in to talk about the programmes they'd seen. And of course, television was enormously popular then those days. I mean, there was no streaming or anything. There was just the BBC and ITV. So lots of people watched, and we built up a huge audience for the programme, and it became very popular.
Do you think that would work now with social media?
Social media has exploded within the whole of people's behaviour. So there is no longer a dedicated audience for BBC television or indeed for ITV or Channel 4. You watch what you like, and then you follow Netflix or whatever, all the different streaming channels. So what was interesting about the 60s and 70s, and indeed into the 80s and much longer, was that it was a unifying enterprise. The whole country watched one of the two channels, basically BBC or ITV. And that was very interesting, because you built up an attitude to the sorts of values you care. For example, David Attenborough, who was at one time my boss, he was the controller of BBC Two, didn't want to be an administrator, and he left. And he founded this amazing network of programmes that he's been doing ever since about the natural world. And because he had a captive audience, it was an immediate success and has held its own ever since. So it was a unifying enterprise for the country. Richard Dimbleby and later Robin Day presented Panorama, and the country watched Panorama. There came along daring plays. For example, When Kathy Come Home was done as a play, so many people watched it and were outraged by the idea of homelessness. It led within weeks to the foundation of the charity Shelter, which then did something about it. So governments had to pay attention to broadcasting because it had a huge universal appeal, and that was very important at the time.
One of the iconic moments on Late Night Lineup was from the episode featuring comedy writers giving the legendary Johnny Spaight the opportunity to explain the satirical tone behind Till Death Us Do Part. Always feels like a pivotal moment in the exploration of satire. Yet why do you think that nearly 60 years later, audiences continue to be divided over the true messages behind Spaight's work?
Well, Johnny Spaight was a very witty man, and he cared enormously about comedy and making people laugh. He was enormously enlightened human being. He disapproved of bias and bigotry and all the things that he wrote into Till Death Us Do Part. He wrote it to demonstrate how poisonous it could be. Of course, it made a hero in some people's minds of the characters, but he himself believed it exposed the bigotry that, you know, that he despised and wanted to do something about. So he wanted you to feel, aren't these people awful? What a terrible way to behave. And of course, he vested in the daughter and the son-in-law the views that he himself had, you know, that the central character, a silly old man. So he liked to challenge. And he believed in free speech, so he didn't have any feeling that that sort of talk should be censored. He believed in showing it and then talking about it, which, of course, we did. He came on our programme a lot.
Josh actually used that clip as his dissertation at university.
Oh, well done. Well done. Yes, it's very important. It was very important that these views were expressed. And sometimes we like to believe that the audience might recognize themselves in these terrible characters and think, oh, they're not really right, are they, to behave like that? You know, they made a case for it. It was very good. I bet the dissertation was good.
After Late Night Lineup, you went freelance, sharing your time between ITV and the BBC. How was TV Centre viewed by superior members of ITV senior management like Lou Grade, and what effects did your experience as a former BBC TV anchor give you an advantage over your contemporaries?
Well, the interesting thing about ITV at the time was that it was divided into, I think, 12 companies. So each of the companies, Granada was one, which is in the northwest of England, and I went to work for them, and they had a huge centre of their own. They had a huge building in the middle of Manchester with studios, facilities. All that's been knocked down long since. But that was a complete business, very successfully under Lou Grade, very, very well run. Then there was one in, there were 12 of them. There was Yorkshire, which had a studio network in Leeds. So they each set up their rival TV centres, if you like. There was one in Harlech in Bristol. Harlech was divided between South Wales and Bristol. And there was a centre in Bristol, which I sometimes went to work. There was one in Plymouth, which was, I forgot the name of the franchise, but that was the south area of the country. So the ITV network was divided into these 12 companies, I think. It all changed. It all changed. But that's what I remember most vividly, because each of them had their own character. Each of them had a very special feel. Granada was rather left-wing, rather explicitly left-wing, and very much into social conscience, doing good in the community and things like that. East Anglia was more, I did work for Anglia, which had a headquarters in Norwich, and they did more rural things. They took an interest in the countryside and so on. So they each had their own character, and it was great to have a job in any one of these establishments, because they weren't too big and you could get have your say and make your mark. I rather enjoyed that system, but of course it went long since.
And obviously that's on Granada, that's where Michael Parkinson got his big break.
Oh, yes. Well, Michael Parkinson was on too. Michael Parkinson came along while we Late Night Lineup was on the air. And he was, his producer had been one of our producers and knew how, you know, what the public wanted to know. And of course, Michael was a consummate broadcaster. And that was a show with an audience. That was a very important show, had a big studio and the audience came in to see it because, of course, the celebrities were enormously popular. It was the making of Michael. It was the first of those celebrity shows. Talk shows, chat shows, late night talk shows with an audience, with a huge celebrity guest. Ours was more small scale, sort of late night chat among friends, really. Ours was very informal. There was no audience. And we could invite who we liked, which was a nice freedom to enjoy in those days. And so we covered the arts. We covered everything that was on television. We discussed sport. I didn't, because I didn't understand sport, but we would have jazz musicians. Woody Allen used to come on when he was in London. He made friends with us. All sorts of people came along just to talk about their work, what they did.
Part of commercial television success during the 50s and 60s was the pull of Val Parnell and the London Palladium. However, the BBC forever seek to emulate that legitimate entertainment experience which commercial television could offer. How pivotal was TV Centre in giving the corporation their very own home of unadulterated shiny floor entertainment?
Well, the BBC triumph was, of course, Eric and Ernie. I mean, they were enormously brilliant and they commanded the audience across the nation. I mean, that was it. What was their show called? I've completely forgotten it. remind me.
The Morecambe and Wise show,
that's right. Well, that just, do you know, that used to get audiences of 23 million because everybody wanted to watch it. I mean, I remember going to, and they watched something else too politically. Along came the parody shows, the comedy shows about current affairs. That was the week that was. And I remember going to the theatre in London, going backstage to talk to an actor who I knew, and he was rushing out of the back door saying, Joan, I can't stop. I've got to get home because I've got to see Have I Got News for You? Now, the point about that was there was no recording machinery. You couldn't record a show and watch it later. You had to watch it at the time. And that was both unifying and irritating. So people would say, I have to be home. I can't possibly come out on Saturday night. That was because I had to see that was the week that was. And that was very important as a landmark of political satire. It was created around the time that Private Eye began to publish. So it began to allow jokes at the expense of politicians. And, of course, they pushed it further and further. Now, Eric and Ernie were... on BBC One on Saturday night, they were the great entertainment shows. And they could, you know, any guest would be, any actor, dancer, whatever, would be thrilled to be invited on the show. And there were some landmarks. Do you remember Andre Previn, most particularly, I think, was terribly funny. So, I mean, their pulling power as a programme was enormous. That's now evaporated. It doesn't belong to any single programme on the scale that it did then.
Yeah.
The studio drama seems extremely dated and old-fashioned in today's technology generation. Famous for its wobbly sets, rustic camera work, and devoid of realism, the studio drama bid farewell in 1994. But how important were series like Poldark, I, Claudius, and Z Cars in building the corporation's reputation as a formidable drama factory?
Well, all those would have elements of filming. Initially, when the dramas went to Television Centre, the studios were meant to be used for dramas. Now, the people who made the dramas, the directors, were furious about that because they wanted to be film directors, you know. They wanted to be out on location with cameras and cutting and different opportunities that filming offered. When they were cramped into a studio, they had to make do with the sets that were built for them and were... as adapted as they could be. Now, when it came along, something like Kathy Come Home or Up the Junction, the directors put in a plea with the support of their producers, people like Tony Garnett, who backed Ken Loach. Ken Loach was a pioneer in this, who said, look, we simply have to film on location. You can't do these sensitive issues, social issues about poverty and Up the Junction was about illegal abortion. You can't do that in a studio. It just simply look phony. They were given permission, slightly grudgingly, because, of course, the studios came for free, if you see what I mean, on a drama budget. A studio was free. If you went out filming, it was an expense, and you began to trip over the budgeting parameters of the programme.
Yeah.
But it was a big battle then. Could you make film or would you have to use the studio? Someone like Z Cars had standard sequences. You will remember this, Josh, of the policemen in the cars, which were virtually in every episode so that they could use the same bits over and over. But it was very important because it showed policemen as human and not the old... you know, the blue lamp kind of programs in which the police was just seen as a benign force. Z Cars changed the feel and made them real, gave them faults and made them human in a way that they'd never been on television before.
Of course, in order to develop such a creative hotbed of talent, which TV Centre thrived upon, there was a whole generation of pioneering management who had the vision to create such a defining era of TV. How integral were people like Bill Cotton, Hugh Carlton Green, David Attenborough and company to the development and the presentation of the values which TV Centre stood for?
Well, Hugh Carlton Green was very liberal, that was an enormously important element. He was the top dog, and he had the power to permit, or indeed, could he have wanted to, he could censor, he could say, no, we don't do that. He had the power to do that, but he didn't want it. He enjoyed the great freedom of ideas that simply blossomed forth. And of course, you had wonderfully inventive people with inventive ideas. When David Attenborough was made was controller of Two, colour came in for the first time. And David had two inspirations right away. He said, right, if we've got colour and we've never had it before, we'll have snooker, which, of course, is enormously popular. Mm-hmm. And at the other end of the cultural barrier, he said, and we'll have civilization. And we'll have Kenneth Clark talking about art and paintings, because now we can show Renaissance paintings in colour. So that it was his immediate response to the arrival of colour, both of which were brilliant.
Is it true that before that colour came in, if you were watching a snooker match on telly, the Radio Times would then put the what happened in the match and the colours in the back of the Radio Times so people can then refer back to it so they can actually see what went on during a match?
Yes. Well, you see, it was the absence of colour was enormously inhibiting for all matches, all games, all colours and teams and balls. It was hopeless. And the moment colour arrived, everyone just got the message. That was it. It was wonderful. You're quite right, Josh. It was extraordinary, the arrival of colour. I was one of the people, before they actually introduced colour on transmission, they needed to practice what colour would be acceptable and how. And I was used, because I was on very late at night on BBC Two, not a big audience, they asked me if I would change my clothes each different night to have different things to try out. For example, stripes. They asked me to wear something in stripes. And of course, it strobed terribly. And was they asked me to wear white. And white was hopeless because it glowed too much. Red was too luminous. So they gave me a hook. They sent me out with a wardrobe lady to buy lot. It was a woman. There were not men doing it those days. To buy lots of clothes and try them on in front of the colour camera. And then they told me which ones I could wear and which I couldn't.
As a broadcaster, in what ways did TV Centre make it easier for you to shine?
Well, the most impressive thing about Television Centre was the fact that every morning, going into this building, were every kind of talent that went to making television programmes. So you had people who made props, people who designed the sets, you had makeup people, a whole huge makeup department. You had every skill possible, wardrobes, banks of clothes and things. You had actors, you had rehearsal rooms. Now, we were a programme about television. So we really just were able to look around at who was around, who was arriving, who was rehearsing, who was recording, who was making plans, because there were offices, the different offices for all the different skills. Actually, the arts were still over in a different part of Shepherd's Bush, but the drama had a floor to itself, and we could go around. We could go and say, is Ken Loach around? We thought we'd like to invite him on the programme tonight. So it gave us huge range of people to invite. And they would say, well, yes, I'll stay on it. I'll get some publicity for the programme. It would be good. And that suited me very well. It meant also that domestically I could take my car, and there was a car park in those days. Doesn't happen now. But we could all arrive in our cars and park in the great space next to Television Centre, which is now built on. And we had a car park place reserved. So it was easy. I drove from my home and left my car, just went up the stairs to the office, got on with my job. And then late at night, I was able to drive home long after the public transport had ended because the programme was on so late. I would drive home at about 12 o'clock at night in my car. So the actual facilities were very good.
Saturday night television has forever been a brutal battle between the BBC and ITV for entertainment supremacy. How significant was Television Centre throughout the 1970s to give Bill Cotton's BBC Light Entertainment Department a significant advantage over its rivals?
Well, Bill Cotton knew how to do this when he got the job. He ran an enormous department. They had a floor too, light entertainment. And you could go along with ideas, virtually knock on his door, ask his secretary for an appointment, say, I've got something I want to, you know, an idea I want to put to Bill. She would brief him, and he would obviously not just see anyone who turned up, but he would make a selection of people he'd consider, give them a chance, listen to what they had to say, and then give them right away, say, okay, have a go. So, I mean, he was enormously open to ideas for programmes all the time. And that, of course, the word got round. People started turning up with ideas, putting in programme ideas. And he had lots of producers working for him who he trusted. Dennis Mayne Wilson was a great source of comedy material, and he had the power. The BBC was structured in those days so that Bill Cotton could more or less say, you turn up, you have a good idea, we'll go with it. I don't think it's quite that easy these days, because you have to make a pitch, cost it, have it. There are so many people making programmes, you have so many rivals, which will the head of the department choose and why, and which stars will you have in your show, and all. I think it's probably more difficult now. It felt easy at the time, because it wasn't so dense with talent, aspiring talent, everyone eager to get on. Everyone thought, well, I'd give it a go, and I'd love to be there. But it somehow seemed more fluid in the way that things happened.
Throughout the 80s and 90s, TV Centre became host to the British Telethon. In hindsight, how significant was the building to the establishment of both Children in Need and Comic Relief?
Oh, well, the building, in the sense that it was representative of television itself. You know, if you wanted to speak of the nature of television, you would put up a picture of this great iconic building. And so it became known as the focus of any kind of originating idea that you wanted to sell. So I don't know how Bob Geldof got the show on the road, but I would think he would go and ask advice for people who know how to mount these vast enterprises. It had the resources and it had the wisdom to point you in the right direction, or to advise you and say, no, this is a step too far. You're not going to be able to do that. That's never going to fly. Just don't do it, or go over there or ask someone else. So it was a marvellous networking place, a network for people who are talented and powerful, and people who are talented, powerful, and had the money. So on all those levels, it became an iconic place.
On Friday, 22nd of March, 2013, BBC Television Centre closed its doors for the final time. What was your reaction to this?
I joined an organisation to try and save it. We didn't save it, but there was a small movement went round saying we've got to try and get it listed and have it defended. And all the people who'd ever worked there signed up. We were all very keen, but it didn't have the traction. I don't know whether English Heritage was called on board. Everyone said, it's a BBC enterprise. It's a public money. It's got to be worth it. You can hear all the economic arguments, can't you? And so we didn't get very far. But I was heartbroken. I mean, it carries all my memories. It carries all the memories of when I was young and thriving and, making new ideas. The thing I liked about it most was that in every regard, it was promoting new ideas in comedy, in satire, in dramas, in serious programmes. New ideas was what always interested me, and they were absolutely teeming through Television Centre.
I don't want to get too political, but do you think the government doesn't always do right by the arts?
Oh my goodness, how long have you got, Josh? I could go on for a long time. I've always it was for 15 years the chairman of the National Campaign for the Arts, and the arts find it hard to get money. It always gets harder. We've always got an economic crisis when it comes to the arts. I used to report after I'd finished Late Night Lineup. I became the BBC's arts correspondent for something like 5 or 10 years. And where many of the stories were about money. You can't simply keep doing stories about, here's a ballet company, they need money. Here's a drama company, they need money, because the public don't want to know that. But nonetheless, we did put pressure on the government to keep up the funding of the arts, because it underpins the creativity of the whole generation, of us all. That's why we need the arts, is to prompt thinking, new ideas, creativity. There's never enough. But there's plenty of creativity.
Looking at broadcasting as a whole, how significant is TV Centre in the story of British popular culture, and what is its legacy?
I fear it might get forgotten, because it's now a block of flats, although I do have been there. There's a club there, and I have been there for a drink. It made me a very nice place to have a drink, but it made me rather sad, because the ghosts of the past, I felt, were receding, and people didn't really know what had once happened in this place. I suppose it will survive in the various memoirs that people write, the people who've lived and seen it. And also there must be an archive of what it looked like, and its demolition perhaps as well. Its legacy is the creativity of people who have grown up there and gone and spread the message of what we can do. So his legacy is all the programmes and the creativity that still exists. Ken Loach is still making films. You know, plenty of people remember the inspiration they took from that building and will pass it on. It's not an actual legacy in bricks and mortar. It's in ideas.
Yeah, and that's the same for all iconic buildings in Britain, really, like, for example, the London Palladium.
Yes, it's absolutely true. It is the truth that these buildings have a legacy in the talent of the people who remember them and in people's memories. It's the most you can hope for, isn't it?